This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name, as always, is Alex Perney, and today we are very pleased to welcome on Christopher Zook, Chairman and CIO of Kaz Investments. Now, today we're going to be getting a little bit farther into the realm of what we do professionally here. Most of you know that we do this podcast as an adjunct to what we do at Advanta IRA, handling strictly alternative assets and a lot of different interesting and alternative ways of looking at finance. And I'm really excited to kind of dig into this today with Christopher. So thank you very much for being on with us today. And maybe give us a little bit of a brief background about yourself. You know, kind of how did you come to be in your current franchise in life? And then we'll dig into the topic at hand.
Well, I appreciate you having me, Alex, and look forward to sharing some thoughts. But so started the firm in 2001 with the backing of some very significant families in Texas and around the country. And, you know, I've always been investing since I was literally in high school and college. I've always been interested in investing and finding ways to generate returns. As a matter of fact, through college, I helped put myself through school by trading commodities while I was a student. I learned a lot of lessons, some expensive, some profitable, but really I've always enjoyed the investment aspect. And over time have gotten much more involved in the alternative asset world simply because of the fact that we believe there's such a really solid risk reward in much of the private markets.
Absolutely. And I really kind of echo that as well, at least what I do professionally is that, you know, and we'll kind of dig into this philosophy is that people, you know, oftentimes look at investing and say, oh, well, I diversify. Well, I'm invested in, you know, some, let's say biotech. I own some Pfizer, then I own some Tesla and IBM. And it's like, the principle of this is, yes, you are diversified across maybe the market segments that you're in, but at the end of the day, you're all still kind of all swimming in the same pool. You know, it's the same lake you're swimming in, and, you know, torrential rains can raise, droughts can lower that whole lake as a whole, and things that are basically outside the, you know, even completely outside the scope of what you might be investing in. A very good example that we've kind of really hammered on last year was the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Had a very detrimental effect in the immediate short term in the U.S. securities markets. A war in Ukraine has absolutely zero to do with a mining drill company based out of Houston. I just watched The Aviator last night, so I'm kind of thinking along as Howard Hughes was fresh on the brain. But it, you know, kind of goes to show that, you know, to get true diversity, you really kind of need to look outside of that lake of the traditional securities markets. And not to disparage them, they certainly do have a great place in a lot of people's portfolio. And you know, one thing they do have that alternative assets don't always have is very ease of accessibility. But to that point, I really kind of want to dig into, you know, your philosophy on this because it's something I'm very passionate about. I've, you know, kind of hitched my cart to this wagon for the past 12 years of my professional financial career on strictly doing alternatives. So, you know, we always like to kind of hit close to home. So, you know, where do you kind of want to start on this? If someone's kind of new to this, they've been investing for a long time and they're, you know, they hear alternatives and they kind of go, well, isn't that inherently risky or unsafe? You know, what exactly does that mean to you in your terms when we're talking about alternatives?
Well, it's a really great point. And I'm going to borrow your lake analogy because I actually really like that one. It either fills up entirely together or there's a drought and then everybody goes down with that lake level. So I'm going to borrow that. The interesting thing about it is I'm going to talk about the negative and I'm going to talk about the positives. So the biggest mistake that we see that people make in the alternatives world is that they look for alternatives just for the sake of alternatives. And it's something to where just because somebody says something in the locker room or they hear about this great idea, that doesn't mean it's a great idea. So you have to make sure that you understand the investment. You have to understand the source. And to I will tell you more than anything else, you can have the very best idea and the wrong partner and lose a lot of money. So it's really critical to look for high quality institutional caliber alternative assets. But you must find alternative assets because to borrow from your phrase, you know, if somebody says, yeah, I'm diversified, I own all Magnificent Seven of the Magnificent Seven. Well, when they all go down 45% together, you're going to get hammered. You need to find things that truly do not correlate. And the amazing thing is this is not a new concept. Markowitz, when he won the Nobel Prize in 1990, it was because he proved that having diversified exposure to lots of different assets that did not correlate together. And we hear that term all the time. You know, what is correlation? It's just, do they move together or do they not move together? And the analogy that I like to give people is that if you are staffing a golf shop and all you sold in your golf shop was rain gear, there's going to be some days you're going to sell a lot of rain gear. And there's going to be some days you're going to sell no rain gear. And if all you stocked was sunscreen, there's going to be some days you're going to sell a lot. And there's going to be some days you sell nothing. If you own both or you stock both in your golf shop, you're going to have some days that do well for each, which means overall on average, you're going to be fine. So when you compile that to compare that to the public markets, pretty much everything goes up or down at the same time. Your lake analogy is perfect. If there's a drought, everybody's going to suffer. Instead, if you can find things that truly don't correlate at all, build them together where something is zigging and something is zagging all the time, you likely will get to the same destination. You will just have to accept a much smaller roller coaster ride along the way to get there.
Yeah, and you bring up one thing that, you know, I found very important, especially in the alternative space, is that the lack of information, and I say lack because it's out there, but you have to look a little bit harder for it. But to everyone is, you know, always come at anything with a skeptical eye. Understand the source that is providing you the information and what their inherent reason for giving out that information might be. You have a lot of coverage in the media, whatever your thoughts on the mainstream media are, there's a lot of information out there and it's pretty readily accessible. But when you have to actually get out there and do a little bit more boots on the ground, you actually have to read through some, let's say a prospectus, or you have to read through a PPM, and you actually have to kind of go through and do some nuts and bolts. One, understanding how to do that is very important. And understanding who is giving you the information and the reason why they're giving it to you is something that I like to echo whenever I hear a guest, you know, phrase that out there. Now,
it's so accurate. It's so accurate that, you know, what you have in most situations is people will do what's in their selfish best interest. That's okay. But you need to know what that self-interest is. And what we have is there's two phrases that I think apply, and I mean, I hammer these home in every conversation with our investment committee and every conversation with investors. These two principles apply. Number one, we're freakish about alignment. Where there's good alignment, there's usually good decisions. Where there's bad alignment, there's usually bad decisions that are made. And that doesn't mean people are bad people. It just means they're on the opposite side of the table. So it's really important to know what somebody's selfish best interest is going to be and make sure you're not going to suffer as a result of that. The second phrase and the second principle that we would apply is that if you can live with the worst case scenario, the upside will take care of itself. So we focus 90% of our time or more on what can go wrong. Most investors only focus on how exciting it is and how interesting it is and how much money they're going to make. And, you know, they're going to do this and they're going to never have to work again. Well, that might be true. It's probably not. So know what that downside is. And to be very clear, it's okay if the downside is zero. If you truly believe that the downside is zero, just size it properly. And that's where most people just make mistakes, is they put too much into the thing that's the most interesting and not enough into the things that are kind of boring because of the fact that they just think, oh, this is going to make me so much money. And then they ultimately get bit in the tail and it's a real problem. There's one of our favorite investments that we've made. There's a company out of Austin called Icon, I-C-O-N. Just go to Google, type in Icon 3D printed homes, and you'll actually see a 60 Minutes interview a couple of weeks ago. You'll see some really cool videos. The company prints a house with a 3D printer. Literally, they print a house in 2 days with a 3D printer. We were one of the seed investors in the company. And I went to all of our investors and I said, if you're going to invest in this, literally, I got really close to the screen and said, you're setting your money on fire. It's going to be gone. But if it is not gone, we might just change the world. And sure enough, it's now about a 50X from our entry price. And it's something that doesn't happen all the time. But we went into it knowing that zero was a real possibility and probably the likely scenario. We were okay with that. So we sized it correctly, and now we have the benefits of doing something that literally is changing the way the home is being
built. Yeah, absolutely. Understanding kind of the risk value proposition in anything is inherently very important.
And that's, it's actually very interesting because of the fact that now, if when you go online, you'll see they're not only printing homes in the more traditional way, but they also are printing them with some of the most unique designs. They actually built an amphitheater in Austin, literally in a matter of weeks, out of concrete, out of a printer. And so they can use all kinds of shapes and angles. And it certainly is an evolving process, and every single printer gets better.
Great. So we understand the inherent risks with doing some things. There, you know, the old analogy, there's, you know, without risk, doesn't come reward. And to the example you gave your investors of the 3D printed concrete buildings, you know, this might be setting it on fire, but if it doesn't catch on fire, it could be a multiple X return on your investment. Which again is very important to kind of understand when investing in alternatives, is that you might be taking on, with some of them, a higher degree of risk, but the inherent reward can be very significant. Now, I always like to kind of build a pyramid. So alternative assets mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. In general, kind of the high level with what you deal with in your investors, what would you say your definition of an alternative asset is for someone strictly coming from Wall Street saying, hey, I buy blue chips, but I'd like to have some real diversity in my portfolio?
You know, it's actually, I chuckle a little bit, Alex, because of the fact that, you know, I get asked this question a lot, and it's probably one of the greatest misconceptions that you point to, which investors just simply don't understand. An alternative investment is just something that's not publicly traded. So if you can buy it or sell it on an exchange, it's publicly traded. If it's not something that can be bought or sold on a public exchange, like the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, it's an alternative investment. Your house is an alternative investment. My home is an alternative investment. My, you know, vacation property, my home in the mountains, whatever it may be, it is an alternative investment. If it is designed to generate return, whether that be art, whether it be, you know, some kind of a collectible or simply a bond that is issued by a company that doesn't trade on an exchange. Or a lot of people don't realize this, 87% of all of the companies in the United States that do more than $100 million in revenue are not public. Therefore, every single one of them is an alternative investment. And the great thing about your pyramid statement is that inside of the alternative asset world, you can find the safest things and the most speculative things. Icon was given as the example. That's the tip of the pyramid. That's the very top of the pyramid. Across the bottom, you can do private credit that is belt, suspenders, and a rope kind of safety. And you can have everything in between, whether you talk about owning a piece of a professional sports team like we own, or if you talk about owning a piece of a private asset management firm, or simply owning a piece of a company that does last mile delivery or a warehouse that stores cold product before it goes to the grocery store. All of those are alternative investments. And you can match so much easier your risk profile, your reward objectives in the private markets compared to the public markets, because certainly there's variety in the public markets, but it's a little bit more of a one size fits all within, obviously, different types of asset classes. Again, Magnificent Seven, you're pretty much buying the same thing, whether you buy one or two or five or seven. If you instead go out and buy a lot of small caps and middle market, international and emerging markets, certainly you're getting diversity, and that matters. But in the private markets, that's where more than 90% worldwide of all of the actual things you can invest in are not traded on a publicly traded exchange.
Yeah, and you make some really good points to that. And one thing I'd like to kind of build on for that is that if there's a particular market segment you really like in traditional securities markets, you can find that in the private markets. And the nice thing about the private markets, and I've had some, you know, been very blessed with this podcast to interview some very interesting people from some people that actually invest in short line railroads. They go out and buy railroads, which is amazing. I've actually, to your sports analogy, I interviewed the CEO of United States Soccer League, kind of the subsidiary feeder league to MLS, you know, about investing in sports franchising. There's a lot of different ways that you can look at this and say, okay, well, I see the big people out there, but, you know, what does it mean on the granular level? Well, the nice thing is that you can go in and invest with people that have aligned investment profiles that say, hey, like, here's what we're looking to maximize. We're looking to maximize growth in our sector, or we're looking to maximize shareholder returns. Whereas everything on the stock market is basically shareholder return, shareholder price. You get to really kind of align your investment principles with the companies you're investing in and really tweak your risk profile accordingly, which is something I find very interesting.
No, it's so, very interesting. And it's something to where you can also invest more based on your own values and your objectives and the impact that you want to have. It's so much more customizable. And to be very clear, that doesn't mean there's not a place in the public for public securities, right? In every portfolio, there are. And as you said earlier, you know, there is one thing you give up with most alternative investments, you give up liquidity. So there is a trade-off, but you also should get paid for that discount, which is why for 35 of the last 35 years, private equity has outperformed public equity. When you look over the last 40 years, you're talking about 500 basis points of outperformance of private equity compared to public equity. That's a 50% higher rate of return compounded annually. That is the difference between $1 million growing to literally $12 or $13 million, depending on which index you look at, to literally growing to $130 million. I kind of like the 130 more than I like the 12. Don't get me wrong, that's not bad. But I'd much prefer to grow faster and with more customization. So that is why, going back to your point, you know, it's just so important to be able to find the right partner in the alternatives world that is aligned with you, that has objectives with you. And as I said earlier, you know, you want to be freakish about alignment. Make sure that they have a lot of their personal capital invested in whatever it is that you're investing in. And you want to be sure that they don't have any conflicts of interest that you're not aware of. There's conflicts everywhere, right? You can't avoid it entirely, but you need to know where they are, and you need to make sure that their conflict of interest is not potentially going to put you into a position of negative outcome.
Yeah, and I think we're kind of really transitioning well into the next point I wanted to ask you, is that whenever I talk to people in the alternative space, whether they are some type of sponsor of something, whether they're the investment provider, whether they provide some type of advisory service or are alternative asset investors themselves, are what are kind of your principles, and especially with being the head, the chief investment officer of an investment firm, what are kind of some of the guiding principles? And, you know, in our pre-call, we kind of talked about, you know, a big seven overarching principles that you like to follow. So let's kind of drill into that, because, you know, as we talked about before, understanding the source of the information and getting good information is great, but also understanding the principles of how this stuff, how people invest in this as it differs from the traditional securities market is paramount of importance.
So first rule, Mr. Buffett, you know, is famous for this quote, so I'll give him credit for it, which is that the first rule is don't lose money. The second rule, don't forget the first rule. So that's not always possible, but I will tell you the statistic that I'm most proud of is over the last 30 years that we've been in business, 30 years of my career, 20 plus years that we've been in business, we have made money on 94% of all of our realized and unrealized investments over the last 23 years. That is a batting average that I'll put up against anyone. And the reason our batting average is so high is because we're so obsessed with the downside. And doesn't mean that we're not going to be wrong. Everybody's going to be wrong. The key is to be sure that we're getting paid really well to take the risk that we're taking. Going back to the point of Icon, that's an example of one we were willing to take the risk because we saw the upside was worth it. But we most of the time are going to be focused on things that have a lot more predictability. So first rule, focus on the downside. Second rule, know where the alignment is between you and the person that's asking you to make that investment. Where are the conflicts? How do you mitigate those conflicts? Number three would be understand the wind, the theme. Where is this trend? You know, people think we own professional sports teams and we own over 30 different franchises around the world, including, you know, Aston Martin in Formula One and the Golden State Warriors in basketball and baseball, the Boston Red Sox, Houston Astros, LA Dodgers, and others. It has nothing to do with sports. Zero to do with sports. It has everything to do with cord cutting. And I'm going to guess that probably 95 or 99% of your listeners and those that are watching this podcast believe in cord cutting. There's going to be less people watching a traditional cable box or broadcast TV 2 years from now than there is today. So cord cutting drives advertisers to be forced to go to live events. Well, 97% of all the top live events last year were live sporting events. No accident there. The trend, the theme is really, really, really important. You need to also understand what is the edge What is the alpha that is being created? You know, there's nothing wrong with getting beta, and in certain circumstances, just getting whatever beta being whatever the market generates, that's fine. But you really want to generate alpha, and you want to find alpha because there's an edge that's being brought. Maybe, like as an example, Vista is the largest enterprise software in the world, investor in the world. All they do is enterprise software. They have forgotten more about enterprise software than most people invest in it will ever learn. They have an edge. They've got an information edge. The other thing is positive asymmetry. Positive asymmetry comes from having a very significant protection on the downside with a very significant amount of upside. So it looks more like this, okay? You know, I want to be able to know that heads, if it goes wrong, then I'm going to lose maybe 20% of my money. But tails, if it works, I'm going to make 2x or 3x or 4x times my money. It's not always possible to do that much asymmetry, but you should look for it. You know, Tony Robbins, our partner, loves to quote Paul Tudor Jones, so I'll give Paul credit, which is that, you know, every time he makes an investment, he wants to believe, needs to believe, better phrase, that he's going to make 5 to 1. So he doesn't have to be right more than 20% of the time to actually make money. Now, obviously, he hopes to be right a lot more than that. But if you're right, you know, make 5 times for every dollar that you lost, on average, you've got a great setup to have a really, really good return. The other thing that you must have is you must have a plan for exit. Maybe that's an IPO. Maybe you're going to sell to a strategic. Maybe you're going to do a financial recap. But you need to know when you get into it, okay, how am I going to get out of this thing? And to be clear, that doesn't mean you don't own it forever. You know, some of the businesses we own, we know we'll own for 15 or 20 years. We want to because they're phenomenal businesses that we can't replicate. But we need to know for sure how we're going to get our money back. That may just be in the form of cash flow, or it may be in the form of a definitive exit. And most importantly, like if there's nothing else that your listeners listen to, this is the one that matters the most. You cannot get emotional about the investments. You have to be ruthless in the way that you are unemotional. It's just an investment. We don't want to fall in love with it. We don't want to make it just because we're excited about it. We want to understand the upside, understand the downside, and then be very clinical about the way that we evaluate when it's time to exit or when the opportunity is for somebody to, you know, to give us more for the investment than we paid for it, or simply because it harvests. But don't get emotional. That Certainly. Is the devil, if you will, for investors.
Yeah, and that's kind of true with a lot of things in life. You know, you should always, as much as you can with many big decisions in life, approach it very clinical as possible. Granted, we're human, we're emotional creatures, but try to divorce yourself from that as much as possible, and the outcomes will probably generate themselves. Now, you mentioned two things in that recap of the guiding principles that you have. I think several of them are relatively self-explanatory, if not, you know, a little bit complex about, you know, trying to focus on the alpha instead of the beta. The beta is going to be there. Focusing on, you know, positive asymmetries in the investment returns. But the two that you mentioned that I kind of want to drill down a little bit on are identifying conflicts and what the exits from these things look like. Because research, I think, kind of drives itself in those middle two. But understanding conflicts when it's not something that has a ton of readily identifiable information as required by, let's say, FINRA or the SEC, and then also if it's not a liquid asset that can be traded on an open market, are two things, especially with the alternative space, that I've found that most people just have the harder time kind of wrapping their heads around. So let's start with the identification of conflicts. From a purely from a research perspective, from the investor coming into this space, how do they necessarily even identify a conflict?
So, you know, definitely the legal documents are going to state out very blatantly whether or not it is something that is, you know, a private asset or not. It's going to have an offering memorandum, a private placement memorandum, a prospectus, something, a limited partnership agreement, if it's a partnership, that's going to tell you what those conflicts are. And no, it's not exciting reading. And yes, it's clinical and it's written in legalese, but you need to dig into that. So yes, you should do that. You can have, you know, attorneys that you hire do that for you if they are knowledgeable about investments. Now, I'll just warn you, there's some attorneys that are really good attorneys that don't have a clue when it comes to investing. So make sure you're getting your information from a source that understands the world and is going to do justice and create value for you. The thing that every single person can do regardless of one's level of knowledge, experience, whatever, is you can ask really hard questions. And here's a good rule. If somebody won't answer your hard questions, don't walk away, run away, right? You have to ask them the questions of, okay, how do you get paid? Do you get paid based on me making this investment? Do you get paid based on successfully investing the capital and getting a percentage of the profits? You know, one of the things that we've had for years as a firm, and this is not always true, but in many, many cases, we don't charge any management fees at all. We just get a percentage of the profits. So if we're the largest investor and we don't get paid unless somebody makes a profit, doesn't mean it's going to work, but it means we're aligned. And that's the second question you have to ask them. And you should feel totally comfortable asking this question. Mr. Jones, Mrs. Jones, how much are you putting of your own money in this investment? If the answer is, well, I don't really have it, run. Okay. If they say, I've got all my net worth in this, that still might be a little bit scary because they might be a little too much emotionally attached to it. But it could be that they have a meaningful portion and you would want them to have a significant amount of alignment with you because they're going to suffer if you suffer and they're going to prosper if you prosper. So ask those two questions. All the rest of the conflicts of interest would be around, are you getting any other form of compensation? Are you getting fees to manage this vehicle? Are you getting any kind of oversight fees, board fees? Are you getting any kind of commissions? Are you getting any kind of, you know, not, I don't want to use the word kickback because it's a negative context, but, you know, any kind of a rebate or any other kind of a benefit because I'm making this investment with you? Are you getting a salary? Are you getting somebody paying for the rent on your office building? Whatever it is this vehicle paying for your employees? Again, it's okay if some of those conflicts exist, but you should know what they are, and then you can stack them up and use the old, you know, I think it was Benjamin Franklin approach. If you divide the paper down the middle, here are all the pros, here are all the cons. And then you look at it and you say, okay, can I live with the cons, and are the pros worth making this investment? Just dig in and ask hard questions and don't be afraid to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really kind of, you know, push that. And I've learned some kind of interesting things along the way of, you know, between doing this podcast and having the, I think it's the distinct pleasure of getting to read so many interesting prospectuses and PPMs. Other people might think I'm crazy, but I'm always the one they give the tax law updates to read. So, hey, maybe it kind of fits well. But understanding one, especially asking hard questions, it's your capital. They're going to be stewards of your capital. Ask how they're going to take care of it. That's not outside the realm of possibility, and you're not being rude. And if someone won't answer the hard question, how are they going to answer the easy ones with any type of, you know, validity towards that answer? And also understanding, yes, just because there might be something that you don't necessarily agree with doesn't actually make the investment bad. But you know, you should definitely understand some red flags, especially in things, you know, I deal a lot in commercial real estate and private syndications, things like small differences in syntax. That's why it's important to have an attorney, such as the prospectus saying that, hey, everything's going to be paid out as a return of capital versus a return on capital. So you might be diluting your underlying basis in the actual investment. Now, there might be situations where that's great, but understanding those small changes and how they can affect you are very important. And again, to the point of asking these questions, you know, if the people are acting in good faith, answering a hard question, you know, from your perspective, shouldn't be hard for them. You know, people ask me, you know, what happens if Advanta IRA goes out of business tomorrow? What happens to my money that's with you? I'm more than happy to answer that question. And it's one that I would encourage anyone to ask. What happens if you go away? What happens if this happens? So just understand, you know, it's good to be polite to everyone, but you're not being rude by asking these kind of questions because you don't have regulatory bodies that kind of stick this right in your face. You have to read big documents and understand this stuff if you don't necessarily have an intermediary that you trust, such as someone that's, you know, putting together an alternative asset investment firm that you trust their opinion and their research. But again, trust but verify. And as they say, in God we trust, everyone else bring cash. You're just understanding kind of what you're getting into. You know, that is certainly one of the barriers to entries to alternatives is you just have to be a little bit more studious. You have to, you know, break out the reading glasses. You have to read this stuff. You have to ask the questions because the information is just not readily accessible as it is in more traditional markets.
No, Alex, your point is so valid and so important for people to not like just, you know, oh yeah, no, I do that. One of the things you said at the very beginning of this conversation is that one of the things that causes people to not invest in alternative assets is because of the fact that they feel intimidated by all of those legal documents, et cetera. That's okay. You didn't learn algebra literally without having to work at it. So spend some time, understand it, do the reading, ask ChatGPT, not a commercial. We do own a piece of OpenAI, which is ChatGPT. But it, you know, ask these things. You can learn so much there that it was so hard to learn in the past. But then if you don't want to do all that, you got a job to do, you got work that you need to accomplish, then you need to find someone to partner with that you can absolutely trust to act in your best interest that is aligned with you. And then you need to ask those people the hard questions, you know, firms like mine and others of, okay, what happens if Christopher gets hit by a bus? No problem. That's a fair question to ask. You need to ask those questions, whether you're doing your own homework or you're relying on someone else to do that homework. Don't be afraid. It's not rude. It's your money. Be a good steward of it and expect them to do the same.
And that's a really good question that a lot of people are afraid to ask is continuity of business ownership. You know, if the entire piece of this whole puzzle is contingent on one person, what happens if they're gone? What happens if the board removes them? That's a big one that people don't want to ask someone. It's like, hey, what happens if you die? You know, that's a tough question, but it's important. You know, it's a tough one, but that's one that doesn't get asked often enough. And, you know, you could phrase it as, you know, what's your business continuity plan in the event that, you know, John Smith is no longer the CEO. You don't have to be like, hey, what happens if you fall off the cruise ship? You know, there's polite ways to phrase this stuff, but the point being is that you need to understand this stuff because it's, again, the onus is on you to do the research. The other big part of alternatives that I really feel that people get intimidated by is, you know, the research is a big one, but you kind of hit it on the head, is that part of what you're giving up in alternatives with the more traditional markets is liquidity. A lot of these things have lockups where you are restricted from selling this. There is either, you know, a restriction or a certain amount of time you have to do. They might have a buyback clause where they have right of first refusal for selling of that share or interest. So, you know, people often say it's like, well, if I can't sell it, how do I make money? You know, and it's a very valid question. So to the point of, you know, everyone's in this to make money, not just kind of sit there and say, hey, look, I own a piece of this really valuable 3D printed house company. You know, certainly people understand, okay, they get bought out at IPOs. Great. Then I understand that. But in the general course, you know, how are returns generated and what does it look like from an exit perspective for these types of investments?
So it is very much as unique as a snowflake. Every situation is different. They generally fall into three buckets. The first of which is the easiest, which is you own the company until you don't, and you don't expect to get any distributions. You don't, or the asset, to take it away from just a company. You own the asset until you don't. You don't expect cash flow. You just know at some point somebody's going to have to buy this from you. You better understand who that is, how it's going to happen, when it's likely to happen, what would trigger that to happen, and what happens if it hasn't happened in a decade or whatever time frame that you look at. The second bucket would be firms that throw off a reasonable amount of cash flow or use other forms of mechanisms to generate distributions. So this could be anything from a single asset in real estate to a company. You know, it throws off a little bit of cash flow, but that's not your main driver. But they might refinance in 4 years. They might refinance in 8 years, and you get back some or all of your capital that way. And then eventually they sell the asset. And then the third would be the true cash flow vehicle. So as an example, we're one of the largest investors in minerals in the world, oil and gas, traditional energy, minerals. We're also in medical royalties. We're in things that generate enormous amounts of cash flow, but that really are just a runoff. I mean, you think about a medical royalty as an example. You own a royalty on a patent approved, a patent protected, FDA approved medication. Okay. At some point, it's going to go off patent. When it goes off patent, it's not going to be worth hardly anything. So you better make sure within the time frame of which you own that royalty that you're not only going to get all your money back, but you're going to get a sufficient return along the way. But you get literally a check every quarter based on the sales of that underlying medication. Okay, so it's a very visible, very safe, very predictable, but you don't have to worry about how you're going to exit it because you don't plan on selling it. And everything's going to fit in one of those three general buckets. The key is to just not invest until you know the answer to that. with a level of confidence and certainty that you feel comfortable with, that gives you the expectation that matches the amount of return that you expect out of it. And that's one of the things that I see people just not do enough. They don't do enough of an evaluation on that exit. And then they find out that they're going to be stuck in something for 12 years and they can't get out, and it's going to generate a 7% return for them. Holy cow. Why would I ever do that? In my world, for me personally, I will not invest in anything in the private markets unless I expect both a 15% internal rate of return and a 2x, two times my money or more. And that's just my personal litmus test. Because if I'm not going to get more than that, I'd rather just stay liquid. Now, some things are much safer, and I don't expect to make a 2x. A medical royalty is a good example since I already used it. I might make 1.4, I might make 1.6, I might make 1.7. But if I have high confidence and very little risk of losing money, well, then it obviously gives me a willingness to accept a slightly, maybe it's a 14 or a 13% internal rate of return. But especially with interest rates where they are, if anybody comes to you and says, hey, I got an 8 for you and you can't get out, pass. There's too many other great opportunities in the private markets to do much better to justify giving up liquidity.
No, absolutely. And that's, you know, specific to the point is that, you know, you always have to keep in back of your mind, what is, if you have an illiquid asset, what is inflation doing? You know, if you're only going to be making an 8% return on an investment and inflation is, you know, what the CPI and everything else is, but what real inflation is, if it's higher to 6 or 7, you might only be netting a 1% return on your money for a 5-year lockup. So, you know, making sure you understand the contextual lens of all these investments, especially with liquidity concerns, is very important, and not as important when you can get in and out of things very quickly. But one of the fun things about, especially the alternative market, is that the development of this market, especially since the passing of the Jobs Act under the Obama administration, making this stuff a lot more accessible to a lot more people and kind of defining the roles a little bit better in the marketplaces, is that there are options out there for you that have higher degrees of liquidity, especially when you start looking at things that are under things like Regulation A of the Jobs Act, which can be a little bit more high velocity. Granted, those upsides and some of those bigger returns might not be realized in that particular bucket in the Reg A. You know, you might need to look more towards the Reg D market for that. But specifically, there's, you know, kind of a form and flavor for everyone in these markets. It's not simply something that you have to give up all the things that you like of the more traditional securities market. There is, you know, it's becoming a little bit more Baskin Robbins. You know, there's a flavor for everyone here. And you can really go out and achieve some great results with having true diversity, which, again, is something that I am extremely passionate about. You know, it's what I've been doing the entire part of my career. And, you know, God willing, and the creek don't rise, I will be able to do this for the rest of my career as well. I'm young, but, you know, let's hopefully when all of my hair is turned gray, and hopefully I do have some hair at that point, you know, it will be to that point as well. Now, you know, kind of coming up on the end of this, I always like to highlight what my guests are doing. And one of the things when you reached out is that you're writing a book, which I always find interesting. I've interviewed several authors on this podcast that have covered everything from how to invest in burnt down mobile homes to successful investment principles to personal development. So I'd like to kind of at least touch on that towards the end of it, because, you know, if someone's doing something interesting besides just being successful in investing, which is a great thing to be doing, it's always good to highlight that. So maybe let's talk a little bit about the book that you're writing, and specifically kind of the some of the stuff that you cover in it, if people want to maybe reach out and get a copy.
Absolutely. And the reason why we wrote this book, and just for clarity, so this book will be released on February 13th. I wrote this book with Tony Robbins. And Tony is one of our partners and a shareholder in our firm. And we wrote it because of the fact that the vast majority of people do not have access to what we have just talked about. They do not have access to top quality institutional private equity, private credit, real estate, or more often, they don't even know what it is. So what we wanted to do is to be able to educate the population of investors on what alternative investing is, where it fits in the overall portfolio. And we borrowed heavily from Ray Dalio's terminology called the Holy Grail of Investing. The Holy Grail of Investing is nothing more than Harry Markowitz's Nobel Prize winning theory, modern portfolio theory, repackaged in a way that is understandable for people, which is 8 to 12 non-correlated asset classes, when combined together, reduce the risk dramatically and potentially can increase the rate of return. And so what we did is the first half of the book is literally all blocking and tackling, understanding what is private equity. Why would somebody want to own a stake in a firm that manages private assets? Why would you want to own a professional sports team? What is enterprise software? What is disruptive technology? What is private credit? How would you invest in real estate? And all of that first half is just understanding the pros and cons of what's happening in those areas. And then from there, the back half of the book is we interview 13 of the top private asset management firms, heads of firms in the world. So people like Robert Smith from Vista Equity Partners, basically the largest enterprise software investor in the world. People like Barry Sternlicht from Starwood Real Estate. People like Vinod Khosla from Khosla Ventures. David Sachs, who most people are familiar from the All In podcast, who is one of the original founders of PayPal. And you go through the list, Ian Charles from Arctos to talk about professional sports. And we interview all of them about what separates them and has enabled them to be successful, not just their companies, but also individually. What is their journey of how, kind of like your first question, how did they get where they are today? What lessons would they impart to investors? It's a really, really, really fun book to read. It goes into enough detail to educate. At the same time, it's just a fascinating conversation with people that literally investors would never get a chance to have a one-on-one conversation with. We basically brought the audience into that private conversation with Tony and me and the person that we interviewed.
Awesome. Well, I think that's kind of a great place to leave off on this. It's always refreshing when I get to talk to people that are, you know, in a similar space to what we do this podcast on. As I, you know, said, we do this as an adjunct to what we do professionally as alternative asset retirement plan custodians. And while I certainly love talking to the whole spectrum of people on all sorts of different stuff, I mean, I've interviewed a woman who founded one of the largest crime scene and like a hoarder house cleanup franchises in the United States. You might have seen their videos. They're not something to watch over lunch. And I've interviewed people that are, you know, heads of sports franchises. And I've also interviewed people that, you know, have made millions of dollars investing in mobile homes. So the point being is when I get to talk to someone that's kind of in an industry that's near and dear to my heart, it's always refreshing. Great talking with you today. If people want to get in contact with you, how would they do it? And also, if they'd like to find a copy of your book, is it on Amazon? Where can they get a copy?
So the first answer on the book, yes, it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all of the other places that you would go to be able to buy a book. Just go to Google, type in Holy Grail of Investing, Tony Robbins, or my name, Christopher Zook, and it'll come up. It'll be the first hit. To get in touch with us, it's CazInvestments.com, C-A-Z Investments with an S.com, and we have a contact us form there where we'd love to have a conversation with you and share with you what we're doing with our personal capital. One of the things that we really take a lot of pride in is being freakish about alignment. We have over $600 million of our own money invested in our own vehicles, and we're always the largest investor in everything we do. So we'd love for you to be partners with us. We'd love for you to understand more about what we're doing for our families and do it for be able to invite you to participate as well.
Fantastic. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for being on with us today. This has been another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. As always, my name is Alex Perney, and thanks for joining with us today.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at AdvantaIRA.com and subscribe.